My name is Richard Lamparsky. I've been doing this program for about 3.5 years now. And about once a month I do a program on radio, old-time radio, from the golden age, as we call it. And I think of all of them I've done, Bill Adams' name has been mentioned on every one of them. They always say one of the great radio actors, one of the most pleasant men to work with, one of the most professional actors, so welcome to whatever became of Uncle Bill, I should call you.
Yeah.
I'm a little disappointed you're not fatter. No, I thought you'd be fatter. And, yeah. You're jolly, but not so fat. Yeah.
Well, years ago, I was on a show, the first show that was open to the public, the Collier Hour. I played Uncle Henry. Uncle Henry. And finally, they sent out some, they made some pictures of Uncle Henry. And I sent it out to my sister, one of the copies, and she says, "Oh, I was so disappointed." She says, "It doesn't look like you at all." And then my wife was at one of the performances one Sunday, and I came on, and she said the person that was sitting next to him didn't know who she was, of course. He says, "Oh, my gosh," she says, "is that Uncle Henry? I thought he'd be a nice, fat, jolly guy, and look at him, he's skinny. He looks as if he'd steal candy from a child."
I was going to ask you about some children, and I'm afraid to now because Arthur Anderson is sitting on this broadcast. I was going to ask you if the Let's Pretend kids were brats. Were any of them
No.
I'm one of the oldest child actors around.
Yeah, right. Cousins. And you've been on this program before, too.
Yes, I have, when you asked whatever became of Let's Pretend.
Let's Pretend. We'll probably get into that more on this.
We did have one little brat on there. He wasn't on too often. I won't mention his name. Unfortunately, he's dead now. But he afterwards grew up to be a most charming kid. It was just delightful.
Do you know whom he's referring to?
I'm not sure I do. We'll have to
discuss
this privately.
I'll put that to you.
Well, you've been an actor now for many years. What are child actors like? Are they really the horrors that we're told?
It isn't the child actors, it's their mothers.
I agree with that.
Yeah. That's right. We talked about that, I think, at length.
They're always a danger in any company because they cause dissension. It's a strange thing, but years back, I was playing on Peter Ibbotson with Barrymore and Constance Collier and Lionel Barrymore. And we had two little kids in the company. And the boy was just charming. He was just delightful. And the little girl was younger than he, but she was a brat of the brats. Oh, boy. And her mother was a beaut. And all she was doing was trying to push this kid all the time so that she just made your life miserable. And the poor manager had his hands full all the time trying to straighten out difficulties in the company.
I think grown-up actors are sometimes jealous of child actors because when they are good, they are so good that it's fantastic.
Yeah.
And you say yourself, "I've worked for years to perfect this, and here this little pipsqueak comes and runs off with the show."
Yeah. Sure.
And it's hard to resent them, except when they are little brats,
which,
as you say, is usually the fault of the mothers.
Yes, it's almost always that.
Has either of you seen Curly McDimple?
Haven't had the pleasure, no.
Well, it is a pleasure because there's a girl in it. I think she's seven and a half, something like that, named Dane Johnson.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of her.
Most incredible child I've ever seen. You really can't quite believe that is a child up there.
Yeah.
But she is.
Yeah.
I think perhaps you should mention that besides being an actor, Bill was and is also an announcer. You've announced some pretty important shows.
Oh, yes.
Have you not, Bill?
In the past, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Were you the voice of FDR? Were you more than one show? How did that come about?
I was on March of Time. Well, we had
in which all the famous news events of the day were dramatized.
It was a very funny thing because the March of Time was it was a fine program.
Yes, it was.
There wasn't any doubt about that. And finally, when Roosevelt was elected, the director said to all of us, he said, "Come on down to the BBDNO and get yourselves tested on this. We got to find somebody who's going to imitate Roosevelt." So the day before, I went to a movie and there was
a newsreel?
A newsreel, and Rostow was on it. And I realized that all he did was sing. He didn't talk. He sang. It was a sustained tone. So when I went over to do this thing the next day, there were dozens of guys there. All of them. Julian Knorr was one.
Oh, yeah.
And we did this thing, and when it came to me, I took it and I read it the way I had heard this.
You mean you sang it?
Yeah. And Arthur Pryor says, "Bill, you're elected. Phew. Now, study this guy and get the load on all of this stuff so that you'll be able to reproduce him." So I did a little bit of it. I hadn't much use for him. But I went ahead and did it. And then in 34, I think it was, Eddie Cantor had a show on, and he had Roosevelt written into it as a doctor on the, I think it was the Christmas program. And NBC wouldn't allow it until he got clearance from the White House. And they called up McIntyre down there, and they couldn't get the clearance on it, so they made me Dr. Washington instead of Dr. Roosevelt. And I played it straight, of course. And after that, there was an edict went out to the stations that nobody was to be allowed to play, to imitate Roosevelt, unless he had clearance from the White House. And I was the only guy that could get it. All we had to do was call up McIntyre. Didn't have to touch Roosevelt. Call up McIntyre, and he'd say, "All right, if Adams is doing it, it's all right."
Who was that, Admiral McIntyre?
No, I forget what his name was.
He was his press secretary?
Yeah,
or...
he was his right lung.
Yeah.
Was Westbrook and Voorhees on the radio March of Time?
Yeah.
Did they use his name?
Oh, sure.
He was the March of Time.
He was the announcer.
Well, the reason I asked that is, and I didn't remember this, but someone told me recently that in the films, that they used to show in the motion picture and movie theaters, they never revealed who the voice of March of Time was.
Yeah.
It was quite a few years before people knew it was Westbrook and Voorhees.
Yeah, we did some of those things. I remember we did the first one. I remember the first one we did, they had some pictures of a guy out in Pennsylvania who had objected to the WPA, and he was on, it was quite an interesting story about him, I forget what it is now. And, of course, you had to dub in the voice on the...
You're talking about the film now.
On the film,
yeah.
And this guy... He didn't use his lips.
Oh.
He talked like this, without using his lips at all, and you couldn't tell where he was in the sentence or anything. Oh, it was terrible. I had to make about 30 cuttings of it before we finally got one that was satisfactory. Now, to have to use...
Maybe we should explain what the lip sync is.
I'd have to use his hand motion for the cue for a word. It was a... very difficult.
Lip sync is a form of recording in which an actor must watch a motion picture of someone talking, and he must record the voice, and his lip movements must exactly match the lip movements of the person on the screen.
Yeah, sure.
Which is a very big thing today.
Not
every actor can do it.
There's specialists in this. There's one guy out on the West Coast who, I don't know now, but years ago, this fellow was in great demand. He was terrific.
Well, I think most commercials today, television commercials, are dubbed, aren't they?
Well, no, but when the person on the screen is maybe a fashion model who cannot speak the English language, then they'll have the person say the line, and then they'll later have an actor lip-sync the actor.
But that happens very often, doesn't it?
No, not too often. Not as often as it used to, because the models are getting smart. They're going to acting school.
Yeah, sure.
Or they're just not using them for commercials in which someone has to actually speak.
Now, how long since you've seen each other?
Well, let's pretend went off the air in 1954. Mm-hmm. I don't know why that date remains in my mind so clearly. We've seen each other on the street a couple of times.
Yeah, a couple of times, that's all.
But I had the pleasure of working with Bill for, well, for 9 years we were sponsored by Cream of Wheat.
Yeah.
Before that, CBS used a staff announcer, but when Cream of Wheat, I guess they before that they weren't able to afford you. I don't know.
No.
But,
they never paid me much as it was. I think I got $25.
Well, I think of it. Let's put in that recording I have from the
The theme
album.
Song
yeah,
from Let's Pretend.
Yeah, I want to plug that
Whenever
album.
I mention Let's Pretend, anyone over 30, over 40 says, oh, yes, and then they sing.
When I was in Damn Yankees, I just joined the company. A friend of mine had been playing the part. He died, and they asked me to come and take the part. And so I was on, and I came off the stage after my first scene. There was a girl standing there, and she says, you're Uncle Bill. And I said, yes.
Yeah.
And she says, I knew it. As I was walking behind the cyclorama, and I heard you talking, and I said, who is? Oh, that's Uncle Bill.
You're probably best, now, of all the years you've been acting, you're probably best remembered for that part, right?
I suppose so.
That's the one in which you have been mentioned by name.
Yeah.
If people knew the other things you played, they'd probably know you. But the radio actors were usually anonymous.
Except for you. You're always mentioned in connection with, what was that, do that again now. That commercial you're always doing. When you walk in,
Doan's Pills. They're all dramatized commercials. One man says to the other, what's
that
the matter
with you? Is that a laxative, Doan's Pills?
It's a diuretic. What is it? Whatever that means. It's something for your inside.
That sounds like a laxative.
And one man says, I feel terrible. The other man says, yes, your ears are falling off. You've got green shadows under your eyes. What seems to be the trouble? Oh, this terrible backache. Then I don't know what to do. And says, I tell you what to do. Get Doan's Pills. And then Bill said, good advice.
Oh, yes, yes. Good
advice.
Good advice. Yes.
You know, whenever I meet Bill on the street, I don't know whether he likes it or not. I always say to him, good advice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are we going to hear a little of Let's Pretend music now?
Yes, sure. We'll hear it now. This is the Let's Pretend theme that we were talking about.
American Family Cereal presents Let's Pretend.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I've got a couple more we're going to play later in the
I see.
Yeah, later in the show. I want to ask Mr. Adams about Jack Barrymore. He started telling me a story about him when you walked in on it.
Before radio was even thought of.
Yeah, well, he knew Mr. Barrymore years ago.
Oh, yes. I've known him for a good many years, and then I joined him when he played when he was doing Hamlet here in New York with Arthur Hopkins, and we played in 101 performances at the 42nd Street Theater, and when it was over, Jack said to me, he said, Hoppy wants me to go on the road with this turkey. And I said, well, why not? I said, clean up with it. He said, oh, go on. He said, people don't pay money to see this stuff. I said, well, you'd be surprised. I said, you probably break the record of every house you play in. I'll guarantee it. I said, well, what do you mean? I said, listen, I played with Southern and Marlowe last year. And we played 33 weeks. That's all we played that season. And we played to $667,000. And in those days, $2.50 top.
Mm-hmm. Is that what it was? $2.50 top from a legitimate theater.
Yeah. And Southern Marlowe never played to an empty seat. They played to capacity every performance. Or you didn't. We 1 year we were out, and we ended in Cincinnati on Holy Week. We didn't sell out. Southern never went back to Cincinnati.
That'll learn them.
Yeah. But what was I going to say? Oh, and I said, you can see there's something. He says, my goodness, he said, tell me more. And so I went on talking about it. So when we did go out, we played to the first, our first week was in Philadelphia at the Schubert. And we played to $5,000 more than the Ziegfeld Follies had played to. So you can just see it. Standing room every performance. We played in Cleveland with the 16 below zero and snow that high. And we had standing room every performance.
You know, it just occurs to me when you're talking about Jack Barrymore and being such a great box office draw, I don't think that we don't have matinee idols anymore, do we, in theater?
No.
I guess we do in the movies. But is there a Jack Barrymore around today or Paul Muni? I don't think so.
People identify with the legitimate theater as much as they used to. It's not a way of life as it used to be.
There are a few draws, but I think they're nearly all girls. Julie Harris would be one. And Mary
The reason is that it's gone musical instead of dramatic.
Yes, I suppose so.
You might mention Robert Goulet, but of course all of these people have either been in films and created great followings or nightclubs or television, I should have mentioned.
Yeah.
Of course, he's a singer. I know singers are
matinee
idols.
Oh, you're talking about a romantic
actor.
Yeah.
I imagine Paul Newman would if he did plays, but he doesn't do plays.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't think of one. You're right.
No.
It's quite true.
But speaking of 250 top, now 250 is just about the bottom. That's about the least you can get into a...
Can you get into a...
Can get in?
The last row in the balcony will have 250 seats, and that would be on a... Or maybe for matinee, if you're lucky.
Yeah.
How did you get started, Mr. Adams, as an actor?
Well, back in 1910... I went to the College of Music in Cincinnati, and I was there for 2 years.
studying music, Bill?
I was a singer, studying singing, and the man in charge of the dramatic department couldn't get enough guys to play on his shows, so he got me in, and I enjoyed it. I'd done a lot of amateur stuff at home, of course. Like all kids.
Where's home?
In Tiffin, Ohio.
Oh.
And I played on these things until 1911. And Walter Connolly, who was with Southern and Marlowe, they came to town, and Southern had asked him if there was anybody that he knew that would be eligible for the company. And Walter said, well, I'll find out. So he called up O'Meara, who was the... instructor at the College of Music, a very excellent actor and wonderful director. And he sent me, and I went up to see Southern. And Southern said, after the introduction, he said, well, now, Mr. Adams, he said, would you read a little something for me? So I did. We'd been playing The Silver Box, so I read a scene from that, and he says, yes, that's very nice, thank you. Tell me, what are you doing here in Cincinnati? I said, well, I'm the College of Music. Oh, he says, you sing? I said, yes. Oh, that's splendid. We have a quartet in our company. By the way, what is your voice? And he didn't know anything at all about music. Nothing. Couldn't even sing on key. And I said, well, unfortunately, I'm a bass. Oh, yes, he says, yes, that is unfortunate. Yes. We have a bass. You couldn't by any chance sing tenor. I said, no, I couldn't sing tenor, but I can do the baritone part. Oh, he says you could. He didn't even know what baritone was. He says you could. I said, oh, yes.
He's probably in the business though, somewhere still. I'm sure I've run into people like that.
Well, people like him are.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he said, you shall hear from us. Well, I didn't know that he probably had said that to half a dozen other guys around the tour. But come August 23rd, I happened to see it in a diary that my grandmother sent me. I got this notice to appear in a report in New York for rehearsals at the 34th Street Armory.
Huh.
So there, that's where I got started. I was with them for about 7 years.
Did you know that Bill Adams was the original choice for Just Plain Bill?
No, I didn't.
He was just telling me that. We were chatting about Arthur Hughes before you came.
Yes.
And tell him the story. Which is
Just Plain Bill was five times a week
for
Blackett, what used to be called Blackett Sample Hummus, American Home Product.
Yes.
I don't know what was Babbo sponsored them.
No.
I was on that at the
time.
As a child actor, I was always playing orphans, and they were always named Tommy for some reason. It was a real
adorable name.
Yeah.
And that
cuddly name.
I guess so.
Yeah.
So I'm sorry. You were going to tell a story about Just Plain Bill.
No, well, I was playing in a thing called The Wayside Cottage down in at WOR.
Oh, yeah.
And the Ayers had it, N.W. Ayers.
N.W. Ayers.
And they wouldn't give me a 15-minute leeway on the rehearsal.
Yeah.
Conflict.
Yeah.
So that I had to give up the Let's Plain Bill. And Martha Atwell asked me if I knew anybody that could do it. And so I said, I know just the guy.
Mm-hmm.
So I called up Arthur.
And in those days, a radio actor could do, five or six shows a day. And
run
from NBC to ABC
WOR.
Sometimes the actors would hire a stand-in to read the do part of the rehearsal for him, if that was all right with the director.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you remember Ray Collins with his briefcase, and that briefcase didn't have sandwiches in it.
No.
It had scripts in it.
Yes, sir.
He was last heard of. He's dead now. He's last heard of on the West Coast. What crime series was Ray Collins in?
Oh, one with Burr.
Yes. Mr. District... No?
Yeah, no.
No.
Oh.
But all the listeners know.
Yeah.
I'm the only one.
Yeah, I used to do 30 shows a week.
Sure.
30 different shows.
Yeah.
Well, of course, a 15-minute show only required 1 hour's rehearsal.
Yeah.
That's how you could do it.
And then you do recordings.
Transcriptions, certainly.
With transcriptions, we do it.
And
the trouble going that at that time was, excuse me, that if you blew a line, you had to do the whole show over.
Sure, there was no such thing as tape.
it was
all recorded on, when they say waxing
wax.
A record, it really was on wax.
Yeah.
And the grooves could not be erased. You had to, as Bill said, you had to do the whole thing over.
Yeah. Oh,
they
had
later our glass recordings, didn't they?
During the war, when you couldn't get metal, the original recordings were made on glass.
Yeah.
And then some were steel before the war.
Yes. Of course, the master record from which the others are stamped are made of metal.
Maybe that's what
I mean. But the original recordings were usually made on wax. And I remember a story of one actor down at RCA. They were working until 3 or 4 in the morning, and he kept blowing the same line time after time, and they ran out of wax.
Sure.
They ran out
of... That was John McIntyre.
Was it?
Yeah. And I was down there at RCA making a recording for Ford. And there was quite a lot of technical stuff in it. And I was the voice that ran through the whole thing, did it all, virtually.
Mm-hmm.
And Fred Utels was on, and he was an agent someplace or other. And he asked me a question. And I started out to explain to him. And I went on for 26 pages of talk. And when I came to the end of it, everything had gone perfectly. I hadn't blown a word. Came to the last nut, and I said, well, there you are, Mr. Jones. Now, what do you think of that? Where do you think he was? Asleep on the top of the piano. And I had to do it all over. All over.
Oh, no. Speaking of child brats, I remember something I did down at the RCA recording studios on East 24th Street. Paul Stewart is a Oh, we've seen him in a lot of movies. Well, that, yeah. We were doing some transcriptions for Lifebuoy Soap.
Yeah.
And Mickey O'Day and myself, Michael O'Day is another West pretender. I put him up to it. He was asleep. He was tired. He'd done his six shows that day. And we shook him, and we pointed frantically to the script as if to say, my God, get in there, you're on. So he got up off the microphone looking for his place in the script. Of course, he wasn't in it at all. I'm sure he hated me from that day onward.
Yeah.
The poor guy was fast asleep.
That's a horrible trick for an actor to play. Yeah.
Well, I didn't... I don't think I was a brat. I think I was a little smart for my britches, and I think... never nasty. I think child actors, some of them became little sort of miniature grown-ups. Some were very good businessmen.
Oh, yeah.
And you could reel off all their credits and so forth.
Yeah.
But most of us grew out of it and grew into successful grown-ups, and a few left the business and happily in something else.
Yeah.
Let me play another recording, because we have just, I think, about time for one more.
Hello, nephews, nieces, too, mothers and daddies, how are you? This is Uncle Don, all set to go with a meeting on the radio. We'll start off with a little song. To learn the words will not take long, for they're as easy can be. Come on now and sing with me. Hibbity-git, hotza, ring-bo-ree, Simonius, kiffity, high-low-dee. Honey cold dope with an alley kazan. Sing this song with your Uncle Dan. That was swell. You get four breaks.
That was the opening to Uncle Don. I mean, were you ever confused with Uncle Don?
No.
I was thinking.
I knew him, of course.
Yeah. Did you? What's your comment on the famous story?
Oh, it was quite possible.
I'm sure.
Well, you know, I've heard a number of people, Barry Gray included, who said to me it never happened.
Yeah.
Never happened. It was just a funny story that someone told, and people started believing it.
Yeah.
You were about the age to listen to Uncle Don, weren't you?
Oh, sure.
Do you remember the...
His landing in his puddle jumper on the roof of WOR, and I heard the story. I didn't hear the broadcast in question.
Yeah.
I'm quite willing to believe it happened.
And you know, he used to...
I'd like to believe it happened.
Yeah.
It's a lovely story.
He used to, on people's birthdays, you remember?
Oh, yeah.
Little
Tommy Jones.
Little Tommy Jones has a birthday today and so forth, and he'd go on and elaborate on this, and... So I got a hold of him one day, and I said, now, Don, my wife,
Don Carney,
my wife has a birthday on the 16th of October, and you give her your general run of gab, but at the end of it, I want you to say, and Eleanor, I want you to stop scratching your face. So this thing came on October 16th.
So how did you get her to happen to listen to it? It wouldn't be a program she would listen to.
Oh, yeah, well, there's a program on a day that you've got to listen to. And I got there and just pulled her up to the radio so she heard it. And when he came to that, he says, and Eleanor, I want you to stop scratching your face. What she said to me is hardly printable.
Yes, must have been broadcastable.
That must have been a local program.
Oh, yes, it was.
From O.R.
I think of something that happened not on Let's Pretend, but between rehearsals of Let's Pretend, which to me was the handwriting on the wall of what was happening to radio in general, because Let's Pretend was broadcast in a theater, the same one that Ed Sullivan television shows broadcast on. We had an audience of enthusiastic children. And between in the rehearsal break, just before we went on the air, I was in the little boy's room, and the father brought his little boy in, and just they were going upstairs and see us on the radio, and he didn't know I was on the show. He said, "Now remember, Tommy, you're not going to see anything. This is only a radio show." And I thought, well, only using the word only, I guess we know where we stand now. And of course, not much longer after that. Radio became an entirely different medium.
Well, I saw something last summer in California. I went to a Golden Night of Radio or something at the Hollywood Bowl. Frank Duvall produced it,
Well,
and his orchestra was there. They had everyone there. Barbara Lovie and Les Tremaine, the Mary Mack, Ginny Sims, all these people from the 30s and 40s.
Yeah.
They did a scene from First Nighter. Ezra Stone and House Jameson did a scene from Henry Aldridge with Harry Ackerman directing and written by whoever wrote Clifford Goldsmith, I think.
Yeah.
They had everyone there, and I want to tell you, it was terrible. It was awful. We laughed at it rather than with it. And after they got into it, it was strange. Everyone was doing their own thing, evidently, at rehearsals. They couldn't really tell, I don't think, what kind of a show they had.
Mm-hmm.
But once they got out and the audience reaction started, I think everyone was a little embarrassed about
it. What was the audience reaction?
It began with embarrassment.
Mm.
And then they started laughing. They started laughing, although it was a rather touching scene.
The wrong kind of laughter.
Yeah, that Barbara Luddy was doing. And she takes herself rather seriously for good reason. She's a good actress.
Yeah.
But it didn't come off, really. I got the impression that if this is what I remember, there's something wrong with my memory because it wasn't that good.
Well, we all hear
times change,
stories about wouldn't it be wonderful if radio came back, but I wonder if it would.
Yeah.
I think for dramatic shows, it still would be very good. As long as people read stories, radio would be good.
Well, being an actor, I think it would, too, but I'm prejudiced because I think that radio, and especially Let's Pretend, was a good example of that. Things could be done on radio which could never be done on television because in radio, your imagination was working along
part of
with
the cast.
It was part of the cast.
Sure. I think if radio had kept up, or if it begins again as it was before, if it had kept up, as television is beginning to catch up with people's mentality, and movies, I think, have sort of... entertainment in this country is always about 20 years behind the general public, I think.
Well, I think WBAI is one station that has...
We're a little ahead. We're a little bit too far ahead, I think, of the general public.
But this is not the conventional radio station, and maybe in a sense the WBAI is... I don't know if it's the radio of the future, but it's certainly...
It'd be nice to think that in a way. It was.
You know, there was one thing about Let's Pretend that was rather remarkable.
You're tuned to WBAI in New York City.
We used to have enormous audiences. We played at the 53rd Street Theater, the old Hammerstein.
Right.
And there would be 1,400 kids there. Well, now you take 1,400 kids and you're going to find some brats in there who want to show off, you know, with the show going on, it was supposed to be very quiet. And every once in a while, some kid would get out of step. And I was supposed to keep him calmed down.
Sure, Uncle Bill.
I never had to. The other kids did it. Oh, boy, if some kid started throwing his weight around, they would just lay him cold.
Oh, but this is a terrific loyalty.
Yes, sir.
Let's not miss a word.
Yes, sir.
I'm sorry we're out of time. I think we can get into some more stories here. Bill Adams, Uncle Bill, I want to say thank you for being here. And Arthur Anderson, for dropping by on such short notice. And until next week, this is Richard Lamparski. Thank you for listening. Good night.